Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my pal, Mark Metzke.
Hello there. How are you, Seth?
Hey, I'm good. We haven't done this before. This is totally natural.
This is the first time we've touched base today.
We haven't talked. This is the first time we've ever spoken, actually. Period. Never spoken before this moment.
Who are you?
How did we meet? How are things, Mark?
Things are okay.
Yeah. Anything?
No, things are as good as they can be, I think, under the circumstances, trying to make a number of things work.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last 2-3 weeks, I've had to make more executive type decisions than ever before and live with the consequences of them, which so far things have been okay, but just a very different approach to life in general, which we got into before.
Yes, on another episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm finding my favorite podcasts right now are the ones that don't even address what's going on in the world. So that's kind of like the direction I'm trying to go with this. It's like for however long the episodes are, just kind of forget these things are even happening. House cleaning wise, monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Mark and I really want to do an episode with listener mail. So if you want to drop an email to monsteropolismail@gmail.com, you can do that. People are complaining in the chat about the fan, but the fan is going to have to, you're just going to have to deal with it. Because I've got different audio for the actual recording of the show that won't have the fan. So I'm not that concerned about the fan. Yeah, and if it has the fan at this point, I just don't care.
It's the equivalent of the crickets.
Yeah.
So if you can put yourself in that frame of mind, except we're sitting by a babbling brook.
Yeah. Pretend we're sitting in a field in Washington somewhere. And there's one of those huge, wind things, energy.
A wind farm.
Yeah, it's a wind farm. We're recording at a wind farm this week.
That's something we would do.
I would love to do that. Did we see any wind farms when we were out there? I don't remember.
I don't recall any. No, yeah. I don't think so.
Okay.
Maybe you drive through the Midwest, though, anymore. It's all that's there.
Yeah.
It's wind farms.
Yeah, that's very true. So, elsewhere, if you haven't seen it yet, On the Trail of UFOs is obviously streaming. Amazon, Vimeo on demand, available on DVD and Blu-ray. We are running a sale. I can do this, right? Are people going to complain about this? Probably.
It's okay. Probably. How dare you talk about the stuff that this podcast is about? That's insane.
The Small Town Monster Stay at Home sale runs pretty much. We're just leaving it open for now. So if you want to buy stuff, we had to take an order to the post office this morning that was as big as some of our Kickstarter runs, which was pretty crazy. So a ton of people have taken advantage of the sale.
So it's
20% off pretty much everything in the store except On the Trail of UFOs, which is the most recent thing we put out. So, but if you've watched On the Trail of UFOs, please leave a review on Amazon. We love that. It's a huge way to help the project and help it get discovered and all that kind of stuff. Hopefully big announcements coming too for Small Town Monsters in the next 2 weeks, I've been told by certain people that we now work with.
Reputable
sources. Folks. But yeah, there's
Governor DeWine comes out at the end of his press conference and says that the STM sale is still ongoing.
Yeah, just so you guys remember, the Small Town Monster sale while you're staying at home. Mary Acton puts in a little plug for it. What do we want to do? Do we just want to dive back into kind of where we were last week? So for listeners to the show, Mark and I are in the midst of doing a series. There are 6 bottles of half drank water on this table. And I think a couple of them might be yours, Mark.
I was going to say, it looks like our dining room table.
But yeah, we're doing a West Virginia sort of series here. So, for listeners to the show, we're picking up again, this week, diving back into, folklore, and then we're going to sort of segue into other, West Virginia area monsters.
West Virginia hills, how majestic and how grand. With their summits bathing glory, like the Prince Emmanuel's land. Is it any wonder then that my heart with rapture fills when I think of all my loved ones in those West Virginia hills? Oh,
I gotta give a shout out to this book at the beginning of the show. I just got it in the mail. Cry of the Banshee, written by Susan Shepherd. And Susan will be in The Mothman Legacy. She's actually one of the interviews we've already shot. She was a great interview. And the book, it was surreal reading this book, because what I've been talking about for months as being sort of the theme of the movie is her introduction to the book, which is basically like the story of the Mothman and UFOs and Men in Black is just West Virginia folklore repackaged. And she's not writing it off, but these things have been a part of West Virginia history for centuries now, and this is just a new face on an old phenomenon. Yeah. So
does that come through in her interview? You get into that stuff
with
her?
Yeah, she talked about that a lot, actually, and that was she was the first person to kind of bring banshees being a sort of stand-in for a more ancient stand-in for something like Mothman. She was the first person to mention that. And there's some things, by the way, Mark, there's some things you mentioned on last week's episode that you and I have to talk about privately so I can steal them and use them in the movie.
Okay.
Yeah. I love stealing stuff from Mark, putting it in our movies. But yeah, so we want to get back, just dive back right back pretty much into where we were last week with folklore, and then maybe use that segue into some of the more modern day West Virginia monsters. So I don't know where to start us off. I will say, since we're recording this live, if you're in the chat and you have questions directly relating to the topic, please feel free to drop them in the chat. Because as usual, I have done the bare bones amount of research for this episode, and I don't have a lot to say. So it'd be great if people gave me things I could actually talk about. I did want to point out Tracy McNulty is in the chat from the UK. So we have someone from the UK.
Wow,
in here.
Cool.
And Tracy's been following along with STM for a long time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's start us off, Mark. Start okay. Talking so I can sit here.
All right. Well, I think we touched on this particular researcher last time, but I really wanted to dive deeper into her work. Her name is Ruth Ann Music, and she was an educator at Fairmont State University. The library there is named after her to this day, and Fairmont State, I should say, is seen as kind of a center of Appalachian folklore studies, which makes sense given Music's pedigree and the amount of work that she put into compiling these folk tales. I thought one book that I got because we got into this topic, and I just want to, I'll back up and say this. You know, this is one of those topics where you just have the sensation of there's this whole world sort of sitting there for you to discover, you know, and you just go through the door a little bit and you start to get into it and you realize not only have people been here before us, but vast amounts of work have gone into compiling these and putting them together. And now it's just out there for people to discover. So I from a research standpoint, this is the type of thing I love, is mm-hmm. to sort of stumble into a new subject and find out there's a wealth of information waiting for you to pick up and enjoy. So I got her book, Ruth Ann Music's book. Her first book, the one that she's most well known for, is called The Telltale Lilac Bush. And that really got things started. She published that, I believe, in 1965. And there's all sorts of chapters in it. One of them has to do with weird creatures, which ends up being more, I mean, it's a blend, of course, of folklore plus cryptozoology. And there's a whole chapter in it that has to do specifically with white monsters.
Really?
Yeah.
So Grafton Monster was kind of white, right?
Yes. It was white, right? Indeed. And there's numerous white monster reports just in one of her chapters of her book. But to give people a sense of when we talk about folklore, you know, I'm not a folklorist. I don't claim to be one. Folklorists have very advanced, specific ways of cataloging stories mm-hmm. that they use. But in her book, Green Hills of Magic, the tagline for that is West Virginia Folktales from Europe. And that's kind of how you and I got started on this in the first place. It was tracing the European roots of some of these West Virginia stories. Here are some chapter headings, and this gives you a sense of the diversity of the stories that we're talking about. You have Man Against the Devil, Efforts to Outwit Death, vast collection of vampire and werewolf story, Evil Spirits, Curses, and Witchcraft, Dragons, Giants, and Other Monsters, Magic Objects, Elements, and Powers, Little People, Impossible Tasks, and Friendly Counsel, Spirits of the Dead, Luck, Wealth, and Good Fortune, Religious Stories, Family Relations, Wise and Foolish Folk, and then miscellaneous, if you can believe that. There's even just stories that they had trouble cataloging because they're so weird. And, you know, that just gives you a sense of the, when we say folktale, I mean, it can be any one of those or a combination of themes in the same story. And what this book that I'm drawing off of is, you know, 307 pages. Mm-hmm. of collected stories and who told them and under what circumstances they were obtained. So that's just a gigantic amount of work that's already been done on this note.
Folklore, I always, especially because I'm friends with a PhD in folklore, and then Heather Mosier's in the chat too, by the way. She said Green Hills of Magic by Ruth Ann Music is sitting right here on my desk. So there are people that listen to the show that are far more qualified to speak about folklore than I am, and especially because I have a hard time even sort of separating folklore from myth or legend, like defining what separates those from one another. So, but something like this, like the folklore, I know we talked about this a little bit last week, but the importance of documenting that folklore, especially in a place like West Virginia, seems so intrinsically tied to who people in that state are as people. Like, it seems like it's as important as documenting something like the battles that have been fought in historical places. And that's something that I think gets overlooked a lot, especially because the older generation still have a strange outlook on folklore and things like cryptid stories. I think they're probably more welcoming of the folklore, but in a lot of places it's still sort of scoffed at, like these stories, like they offer nothing of importance to the history. The thing that springs to my mind when I'm talking about that would be the lady we interviewed from Momo, who considered the Momo story nonsensical. And she feels the same way about a lot of the folklore from that area. And I think she's a stand-in for like how the older generation in general sort of views folklore. Mm-hmm. Heather could probably contradict me on that or bolster my opinion on that. But something like this is interesting because music would have been doing this at a time when there probably wasn't a lot of the documentation of folklore, period, right? Countrywide?
Right, yeah. I mean, she's generally regarded, I know now, as definitely a forerunner or pioneer, and doing so in such a state and a region that's rich with folklore, you know, just living in the memory of the people that live there. It was the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, she's a trendsetter for sure.
Yeah.
And collecting the stories herself, just really inspiring figure, really.
Mm-hmm. One thing we didn't talk about last week, and this would probably open up some doors for other discussions as well, maybe even throw another episode in, but granny witches. I was fascinated during the run-up to our first shoot for Mothman Legacy by the idea of granny witches, because it's this weird thing where, and I don't know if you got into this at all in your research, but West Virginia stands apart from a lot of other areas. It's probably not just West Virginia. It's probably a lot of Appalachia down into North Carolina, even, because I'm aware of the same thing down there. But there's a blending of spiritualism with Christianity. And it's something you don't see that in other parts of the country. There's a very distinct line between the two. You know, you don't typically see a lot of blending of the two, but apparently a lot of that comes from the roots of the people that were in the area. So they would bring in some of their, you know, like Celtic traditions or Scottish tradition, like whatever their nationality was or origins were, and they would blend it with Christianity. And mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting because in my mind, see, leading up to this, I thought granny witches had to have been sort of like a separate part of society, like these people that were kind of cast off. And then I find out that was pretty much all the older women in the area somehow were like divining rods or like whatever. And they were sort of like combining the two, which I thought was interesting. And there, Susan has a whole section of her interview where she really talks about this and goes deep into like the granny witch stuff.
Yeah.
And I also just thought that was such a unique aspect of Appalachian mm-hmm. life. Like that's just part of how they functioned. The table turnings and the whole thing. Like they,
oh yeah,
they were
right.
Did you get into any of that during your research?
I not deeply, but there's, yeah, that very much is the case. And some of that I think has to do with the era as well. Mm-hmm. Like if a lot of these cases, a lot of the folklore, the people passing the story down, would have been doing that at a time historically when just in the country, just across the United States, there was a fascination at the very least with spiritualism and seances and things of that nature, and people trying to harmonize what the spiritualists were saying with more orthodox branches of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a couple things going on there at the same time, but certainly in West Virginia and with the people groups coming through and some of the isolation of the people and sort of a homegrown sense of, you know, who should be a spiritual leader. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not like it's not an outside hierarchy planting churches in Appalachia. You know, they're homegrown do-it-yourself congregations. Mm-hmm. It's really whatever the people want to decide is true. Is what's going to be true for them. So yeah. That makes a lot of sense that if somebody wants to blend a knocking or automatic writing or something and try to harmonize that with a biblical worldview, I can definitely see that happening. You know, I do have the super short religious story since we're on that topic.
Yeah.
To give people a sense of the flavor of these stories, this one is called Christ and the Blacks. One time there was a blacksmith who wanted to be called master above all the other masters. He wanted to be called headmaster and was insulted if anybody said master. This was during the time that Christ was traveling the world. So one day, Christ came along and said, "Good morning, master." And the blacksmith said, "Who are you? Get out of here." "What is your title?" Christ asked. "Headmaster," the blacksmith said. "Do you think you deserve that title?" "Yes," said the blacksmith. "I can do more than anyone at my trade." Christ intimated that he might be able to do more. The blacksmith said, "You'll have to prove it." Christ took up an old man, put him in the fire until his flesh was burned off, and then put him on the anvil and started to beat him with a cane.
Naturally.
Then, flash, a young man came out. "Can you do that?" Christ said. The blacksmith said, "I've got my dad. I'll make a young man out of him. If you can do it, I can do it better." He dragged the old man down, put him on the fire to burn, and waited. When only a few bones were left, he put him on the anvil and started to beat him with the cane, but nothing happened. The end.
Wow. You going to use that as like an illustration during a service?
You better believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, Easter's coming.
So Susan's got entire chapters in here. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, the one issue that story kind of hinges on is this idea of Christ traveling the world, mm-hmm. which is not classically a biblical Christian idea,
yeah.
but where that does come out of is Mormon teaching. And the Book of Mormon is a lot about this going all throughout the rest of the world, including North America. So not only do you have European traditions suggested here, but also North American sort of non-traditional religious beliefs all going in the blender,
yeah.
and coming out with a story like that. And I think we should also say, too, in terms of folklore, whether people, you know, buy it or not, or whether people think that it's based, you know, a given story is based in fact or not, which, you know, the story that I just read, I don't think anybody was trying to suggest that actually happened, mm-hmm. but almost all of them have some sort of moral. I mean, they're fables in a sense that typically with a folkloric story, there's some theme at the very least that if you do this, then this is what the outcome is probably going to be. Like yeah. in this example that I just read, you know, you may think you're great, but if you have too much pride, that's probably going to backfire. And a lot of folklore has some sort of homegrown moral point to it,
yeah.
at the very least.
So completely absent a moral point. The banshee stories that we talked about last week. Susan has a large section in this book, which you would expect from a book called mm-hmm. Cry of the Banshee. But she talks about a banshee story from Mineral Wells, which I thought was especially interesting. For a couple of reasons. One is that, okay, so first of all, for listeners who haven't been to West Virginia, is a unique, it's a very unique state in general. It's extremely rural. It seems like no matter where you go, even the cities, there's a rural vibe to the cities. And there aren't many cities. Like mostly you're going to come across small towns and villages. That's about it. It's there's Charleston, which is one of my new favorite cities. I mean, we got to go there and stay our first weekend of filming Mothman Legacy, and I loved it. There was an amazing pizza place, which obviously is going to immediately elevate any city in my book. But there was also this great bookstore that we got to go to, but it just had you could walk around, you felt safe, and it was just a really nice. I really loved our time in Charleston.
They have a great minor league baseball park there too.
Probably in Charleston,
West Virginia.
Some sort of cool mascot that you bought like a hat or something.
they used to be called the Charleston Charlies,
mm-hmm.
and that logo in particular, it was a smiley baseball with a cigar in his mouth and a bowler cap.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a Charleston Charlies hat somewhere. Now they're the West Virginia Power, which is just sort of a lightning bolt with legs. It's not quite the same charm.
No. And how do you power? How is a power? Like, what is their mascot? Is it a lightning bolt?
Yeah, it's like a lightning bolt guy.
That's silly. I forget what I was about to say. Oh, well, anyway.
Oh, you like Charleston.
So West Virginia is, you know, to the north. And it's also laid out weird. So when I say north, I don't even know. So the area that borders, no, that doesn't quite work either. It's such a uniquely laid out state too, like just the way it's laid out. But there are parts of West Virginia that are much flatter than others. So typically people think of West Virginia as a state that's dominated by hills and mountains. And I mean, their slogan is the mountain state, which is mm-hmm. strange to me because I don't necessarily, when I think of West Virginia, I don't think of mountains. I think of hills and hollers. And even like how they got the name Mountain State. I mean, I guess it's because the Appalachian Mountains run right through there, but it doesn't conjure the classic view of mountains, like, you know, high rolling mountains and rocky mountains, whatever. It just isn't that. But there is something very, very unique about the state in that a lot, especially the central portion of the state, can feel incredibly claustrophobic and unnerving, especially when the sun goes down. It's unique to West Virginia, that sense. Because we've been in other places where, you know, I've been in the Adirondacks and it didn't have that same kind of claustrophobic feeling that you can get, especially in a town like Flatwoods, which sits down in this, you know, surrounded by hills. There's a lot of that there. But anyway, each area has seems to have its own ongoing folklore or legend or whatever you want to call it. There's a story that's existed there for years, and it seems to get a makeover every few years. So there's this story about the mineral wells. Banshee was interesting to me because obviously the town that Woodrow Derenberger was driving to the night of his encounter with Injured Cold was Mineral Wells. He lived in Mineral Wells at the time. It's a town. It's hesitate to call it a town. There is a downtown, but it's a stop off. It's a stop off of 77 South. You know, there's hotels and there's a like a truck stop strip joint, and like it's everything you expect of a 77 South highway town. But that's Mineral Wells, and I just think it's interesting that they get these, you know, renewed legends that come out of these areas that end up defining them, because apparently this Mineral Wells Banshee story was very popular for a long period of time. Today, I don't think people associate Woody Derenberger and Injured Cold with Mineral Wells, but I always do because that's where the family lived, and that's where he would go on to have encounters with Injured, you know, when he would come to the house was in Mineral Wells and all that stuff.
Yeah, people usually talk about Parkersburg, I guess.
Parkersburg,
because it's bigger.
Yeah.
Probably. I don't know.
Well, he was driving from Parkersburg to his home in Mineral Wells, too.
Yeah.
So he worked. He was a shoe salesman, I believe. Is that right? Shoe salesman?
I don't know. I thought he delivered. Maybe he was a shoe salesman for a while.
See,
he was driving he's driving a delivery truck when he had his first Injured Cold.
I get confused because there was another encounter that happened around the same time. It wasn't Injured Cold, but there was a Mothman story, and it was someone. I can't, these names all blend together, dude.
Yeah, like,
there was someone who you might know this. It's in the Mothman prophecies. There was a guy that was a salesman of some sort. He might have been a shoe salesman, and he discovered tracks, not in Point Pleasant, further away, like 2 hours away, okay. And they looked like giant dog tracks. And this was preceding or right around a UFO sighting he also had. And I blend, sometimes the two stories get blended in my mind because they were both salesmen. And I feel like they might have both been in Parkersburg or something. Can we talk real quick about, I don't even know how to say this, the Monongi, which is, so the Monongi is based in the Monongi, this is the story, this is the one where I can ever remember how to say this word, the Monongahela. Is that right?
Yes. That's how I would attempt to say
it. Yeah. So I wrote down some of these stories. I don't want to read. I hate when I just get on here and read these, but the Monongi is apparently like, the Monongahela's aquatic based monster. It's a lot like the Ohio River monster. It's some sort of like half man, half fish, okay. Like a creature from the Black Lagoon situation.
Yeah, the Gill Man.
And so Denver Michaels actually wrote the Wild and Wonderful West Virginia book, the Wild and Wonderful and Paranormal West Virginia book, which is where I think I first heard about it. And I found on his blog, he did a quick write-up about it. So I'm going to read a little bit of this just so people understand, rumors of a half man, half fish haunting the Monongahela have been around for a while, but are they true? In my book, Wild and Wonderful and Paranormal West Virginia, I discuss the Monongi along with the Mountain State's other famed water monster, the Ogwa, which I also want to talk about in a second. The following is an excerpt. Tales of an evil merman swimming the Monongahela are certainly intriguing. According to what is known about the Monongi, sightings of the monster dates back to the French and Indian War. There's only one problem. It isn't true. When researching the Monongi over and over, this is what I encountered. Legend claims that the Monongi is a manfish that lives in the river. Historical records describe encounters between British soldiers and strange aquatic creatures. The Indian tribes in the Pittsburgh area referred to this creature as Monongi. A Monongi craze continued from the 1930s to the 1950s. Keep note of that time frame. I got to talk about something in one second about that specific 1930s, 1950s time frame that relates back to this, where sightings occurred on a weekly basis and the local police department created a task force with the purpose to investigate sightings of the creature. No evidence was ever produced until 2003 when a fisherman took photos of the Monongi. Photos of the Monongi were briefly posted online but were taken down as the howls of a government cover-up started. I spent a lot of time looking for any information I could find on the creature, but I found little other than the paragraph above, repeated on a number of websites. Newspaper searches yielded nothing. I could find nothing on the Monongi task force that was allegedly created. And then he goes on to basically describe that it just based on his research, he could find no proof that this thing existed. That particular 1930s to 1950s timeframe, especially the 1950s part, is really important because The Creature from Black Lagoon is out. It's, what year did that come out?
54.
Okay, so there's an explosion of sightings of frogmen and stuff in the 1950s. And the reason I wanted to mention this is because I got to go to Charles Mill Lake last weekend.
Oh.
We were trying to find a park, you know, to go for a social distancing stroll in the middle of nowhere. And we thought Charles Mill Lake might be the spot, so we had headed out toward Ashland, got into Ashland County and actually drove to Charles Mill Lake. Unfortunately, we couldn't find a place to get out and like walk, but I at least got to see the lake itself. And obviously in the 1950s there were two boys, and Lauren Coleman's written about this. So if you want to read an actual like good retelling of the story, you can read something by Lauren Coleman. But there were these two boys. I can't remember their names. They encountered or saw the Charles Mill Lake monster, which was a similar description to Monongi, although the Charles Mill Lake monster is unique because it didn't have arms. It was a frog-like creature, frog-man creature with no arms. But at one point, somewhere I have this, I had managed to find an actual newspaper article about the discovery of tracks at Charles Mill Lake by these two teenage boys, or young, they were younger than teenage, they were young kids. And there was a picture of them with the tracks. So I thought that was really cool. But during that time frame, there were all these sightings erupted around the United States. Mississippi River had one of these frog men that would swim up and down and grab swimmers that were in the water. And then the Ohio River famously has its own frogman monster. Of course, you also have the Loveland frogman, which I can't remember when that popped up. Is that 60s?
That was later.
Yeah.
I forget when.
But that 50s, there was an explosion of frogmen sightings. Mm-hmm. So the Monongi apparently falls into that category.
Hmm. What was the other one that you mentioned?
It's called the Ogwa. Or hold on, I sent myself all these, you know, getting ready for last week's episode, and this one I'll just read real quick. The Ogwa, okay. And I don't know if I'm saying this right, but it's spelled Ogua. The tale of the Ogwa continues to be one of the most firmly established and long-lived Monongahela legends. Do I have to keep saying that word? Lau cited an account of the uncommon animal described in the late 1700s by a youth stationed at Fort Harmer at present-day Marietta, Ohio, in a letter to his parents in Connecticut. The manuscript is preserved on microfilm in the Draper Collection at West Virginia University Library Series JJ V 2-4, according to Lau. This is a description from the 1700s. So this is a very old story, but there is an animal in this country which excites the admiration of all who have had the opportunity to view it. Being amphibious, it resides in the water during the daytime, but at night repairs to the land in quest of its prey, which are deer. They just pictured a giant frogman attacking a deer. They lie in the deer paths undiscovered behind an old stump until the deer, unaware of its enemy, passes over him. This creature immediately seizes him and entangling him in its tail, which is 15 feet in length, and notwithstanding all the deer's exertions to free himself, draws him to the water where he drowns and then devours him. One of our men lately discovered one early in the morning with his prey, of which he informed some of the company who were nigh. They soon came up with him and killed him with clubs, but the deer was dead. It weighed 444 pounds. They live in a large... That is very specific. It weighed 444 pounds. They live in a large muddy bank where we can find no bottom. It has two heads in shape resembling a turtle, and by the Indians is called agua or agau, A-G-O-U. I want to find a better description of this thing. What did I just say this thing's called? Agua.
Agua.
Yeah, because I was thinking this was a similar creature to the other one, but now that I'm looking at it, our buddy Adam Benedict at the Pine Barrens Institute actually did a story on this in August 18th, 2018. If you're watching this live, this is true to life. What you're seeing right now is me like frantically trying to find things on my phone and then just, I'll just real quickly go through here and see if I can find some sort of description. While native tribes in the area had long known about the large aquatic beast living within the river, European settlers to Pennsylvania and West Virginia had to learn about it from stories and legends. The native peoples would warn settlers not to venture too close to the water's edge, as the large, powerful jaws of the agua were more than capable of plucking a victim off the shore and dragging them back down beneath the surface of the water. The beast was often thought to drown its victims first and store the bodies in its den, only to devour them later when the time was right. Even though the agua is typically described in the same way as most river monsters, often seen as a dark shape below the water, churns the surface, knocks over canoes, pulls on animals floating on the surface, etc. It does differ from its other monstrous aquatic cousins in one unique way. It is also able to survive on land. I'm just trying to see if he's... Okay, stories of the agua described it as being reddish-brown in color, almost turtle-like in appearance, nearly 20 feet long and roughly 500 pounds. And apparently this does go back to Mississippi and the Mississippi River, which is interesting. So anyway, the agua and Monongi... I could see snapper turtles are terrifying. Like something like that could have originated with an Ohio. Have you seen like some of the really big snappers that come out of the ponds and stuff in Ohio? Like in Bolivar, they used to come up that pond behind my parents' house. They'd come up and go under my parents' fence and like nest in the, not nest, but they'd bury their eggs in their backyard. And there was one time that, there was one that was so big we had to put our wading pool on this thing, and then we got on it, and that was how we kept it under there long enough to get people over that could get it out of our yard. We didn't know what to do with it, but it was as big as the wading pool, and that's not an exaggeration. I mean, we saw them come out of that area that were like 4 feet, like they're just massive snapping turtles. So it could be maybe the roots go to something like that, or the agua might be real. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, they're huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're gigantic from those descriptions.
Yeah.
Something 400 to 500 pounds that can whipsaw a deer with its tail. I mean, that's, you'd think those would be readily findable.
Yeah.
If they were running around the riverbank.
Black dogs also are a big part of West Virginia folklore and monsters. We're running out of time, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but what are you, did you have anything to add here or talk about, talk about the segue from like, cause that was something you had said you wanted to mention last week that I was interested in, is this how you segue from this sort of like classic folklore into modern day monsters.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, and I think that, you know, it circles back to Music's work that she did, especially with the Telltale Lilac Bush, and then a follow-up book that sort of just brought those tales to light was by Kurt McCoy. It's called White Things, West Virginia's Weird White Monsters. Mm-hmm. And you know, he gets into sort of the cyclical effect that folklore has. Once it's gathered in and then people read it or hear the stories, then there tends to be another outbreak of sightings. I mean, it just goes in cycles. And one of his case studies in that regard is about the Morgan's Ridge Monster, which is headquartered, if you will, in Fairmont, West Virginia. Morgan's Ridge, even though it doesn't appear on lots of maps and local people have to point you in the direction of where Morgan's Ridge is today, because that land has been developed and turned into housing, where in the past it was just more wild land. The Morgan's Ridge Monster is a very particular, strange creature that the normal animal that that's most often compared to is a bear, although it has this habit of jumping up onto two legs when he needs to run away. So people often report seeing this white-colored, bear-like creature, and as they get closer to it, it either lunges at them or runs off on two legs, like almost in Bigfoot fashion. And to give you a sense of like what that would look like, there's this really great story of a guy named Frank Kozel and the cruel white creature, which is the Morgan's Ridge Monster, essentially. And it's real quickly goes like this. On a hot, muggy night in July, after working an 11-hour shift in the Consolidated Coal Company's 93 mine, Frank decided to take a shortcut through the woods on his way home. The 93 mine was located up on Morgan's Ridge, above the town of Reevesville. The shortcut through the woods was shorter and cooler than the long walk down the road, which made it doubly inviting. As he was making his way down the hillside, he was confronted by a strange creature. It stood 2 feet at the shoulder, about the size of a large dog, and had an extremely large, powerfully jawed head. It was covered with stark white hair and also had a bushy tail. The creature snarled silently at him, then jumped at him, snapping and biting. Frank swung at it with the lunchbox, but failed to hit anything solid. He punched and kicked at it, but hit only air. The strange white creature continued to leap at him, attacking ferociously but silently as he ran down the path. He could feel its weight slam against him over and over, smell the foulness of its breath, but he could not lay hands on it or strike it in any way. Finally, Frank stumbled near a graveyard where the thing simply vanished into thin air. When he got up and brushed himself off, he found that he was unharmed by the apparently vicious attack. There wasn't as much as a scratch on him. Shaken and badly frightened, he made his way on home. He was still shaking when he got home. That night, he was so affected by the incident, he couldn't sleep. Not being able to sleep after 11 hours of working in a coal mine with the level of technology available in 1929 is evidence of a sincerely serious shock. His daughter, Catherine, said that he never learned what sort of creature it was that attacked him, and more to the point, he never took that shortcut again, despite having to walk twice as far by the other route. So what's interesting is that a creature like that continues to be spotted around Morgan's Ridge and Fairmont, but over time, it takes on slightly different forms. There is a white wolf that is seen every so often, and then that all dies down. Then with the publication of Music's book, The Telltale Lilac Bush, in 1965, and then the subsequent publishings of it, because it was very popular, there started to be a rash of white creature sightings once again, this time extending into the 90s. So what you often have there is, you know, how it's the age-old question of, you know, what comes first? Is it the story and then more sightings, or is it people are sighting something and then telling stories, and how does that feed one off of the other? But, you know, part of the folkloric connection here is so often these white four-legged creatures that are dog-like or bear-like tend to be seen in proximity to a graveyard. And so this goes back way, way back into European folklore, where you have either a white or a black dog that is often seen as a harbinger of death or a warning against, you know, sort of predicting that the person who sees that is going to die soon. So it's just so interesting, because it's, you know, the modern sort of skeptical take on such things. And the modern question always is it real? And in folklore, that was the assumption always was, of course it's real. People saw it. And even in times where there's more of a scientific or, you know, show me proof or tracks of a creature. They still tend to be seen near a grave site or near a graveyard, a cemetery. And it's just really interesting in the case here of in Fairmont, the stuff that's being seen, definitely it just seems reasonable to say that one of the effects of music's work, it was sort of a renewed interest in stories and a renewed wave of sightings. And it just raises so many questions.
Yeah.
What gives birth to what?
That kind of speaks back to the whole entire subject in general. What gives birth to what? Okay, so we're going to continue with more West Virginia stuff next week. I think we're going to get into Bigfoot. If you're watching live, what this means is we're going to immediately begin talking about this right now. So if you're watching live and you're up for another 45 minutes of Mark and I yammering on, you can stay in the chat. There's been some questions we can address in between episodes as well. So thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave a rating and review on iTunes. Don't forget to watch On the Trail of UFOs, streaming online or available on DVD and Blu-ray. Got that sale going on at smalltownmonsters.com. And send us mail to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I don't have anything to do with Instagram or the Twitter. I run the Facebook. Mark operates the Twitter. And Andy Matsky operates our Instagram for us. So, but there's plenty of ways to keep in touch with us. So, next week's bonus episode is going to be an interview with Alexander Petikov. That'll take place Tuesday night live if you want to watch it live. Otherwise, it won't be available until the following Tuesday, but there still will be two episodes next week. So, all right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.